From WBUR Boston, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. In the 1990s, tuition at America's private colleges and universities up 90%. At the University of Texas, Austin, in-state tuition up 45% over the last 3 years alone, and that's a state school. From hikes in the low thousands to $42,000-plus a year, the cost of an American college education seems to just keep soaring. Now there's talk of the federal government stepping in, and there is fear that instead of mixing American society, as it often did in the mid-20th century, college may more often be dividing Americans by the size of their bank accounts. This hour on Point, the high cost of higher education and what to do about it. You can join the conversation. Have you felt the sticker shock? Are you getting the tuition bill paid? How are you doing it? And are colleges now sorting Americans more steeply by class? You can join us at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. We turn first to Washington this hour, and Jeff Salingo, senior editor for the Chronicle of Higher Education. He covers the business and politics of university life. Jeff, thanks for being with us.
Hi, Tom.
So it seems every year this story comes back. We don't have the official figures yet for 2005, 2006, but we see a lot of colleges announcing, and we've got higher than ever tuitions among the elite schools, way up over 40,000, and among state schools, big increases as well. What's the trend here, Jeff?
Well, the trend is every year is it's going up. As you know, we won't have the numbers for 2005, 2006, and for about another month or two. But the other thing that's important to remember is that very few people actually pay the sticker price. When you're talking about the prices you were talking about in your introduction, that's like the sticker price on a car, which these days few people actually pay when you take rebates and other incentives into consideration. About 60% of all undergrads receive some sort of financial aid, and three-quarters of full-time undergraduate students receive some sort of financial aid. So few people are actually paying that actual sticker price listed in the book.
And yet, a lot of that financial aid is loans. Students or families end up paying those back, and we see the debt burden people are coming out of university and college with higher than ever.
Very correct. I mean, about 46% or so of all student aid dollars is now in federal loans, and that's the biggest part of the financial aid picture for a student is a federal loan, which of course they do have to pay back. You know, when federal financial aid was first given out in the 1960s, a lot of it was in the form of grants.
Mm-hmm.
Now most of it is in the form of loans and not grants.
The public is responding to this. Congress is hearing it. We've got a proposal, Representative Buck McKeon, Republican from California, pushing now, that would require public and private colleges to report their tuition and fees annually to the U.S. Department of Education. The federal government would then put out a college affordability index, and if this goes through, colleges could even face the risk of a government audit. What's the impulse here? Are they looking to actually get into the college books and spending patterns, or just to highlight and maybe embarrass the most expensive ones?
I think a lot of it is highlighting it. Representative McKeon actually had a more punitive proposal last year. He had proposed at that time that if colleges raise their tuition and fees by twice the rate of inflation, mm-hmm, for 2 years in a row, they would actually face sanctions, including the possible loss of eligibility to participate in federal student aid programs. That would have been a terrible thing for colleges if that happened to them, because so many colleges depend on student financial aid, and if they didn't receive it, students wouldn't go there. Buck McKeon then eventually backed away from that proposal, and so now the proposal that Congress is considering would place colleges on a government watch list if they consistently raise their tuition and other costs by more than twice the rate of inflation, and would basically require them to provide detailed accounting. But it would not be punitive in any way. So I'm not quite sure how much of an effect it would have beyond the fact of what you just said, that it would just embarrass them.
But it does signal the federal government, which, as you say, is playing a larger and larger role in helping underwrite these growing college expenses, may be preparing to flex its muscle about college costs and get involved potentially one way or another in holding them down.
True. true. I mean, one of the things that Buck McKeon said is that he didn't want to get into the cost control business, and very few Republicans signed on to his proposal last year when he first proposed it. You know, the government has been interested in college costs before. In the late 90s, right before the economy kind of took off, the Congress created a college cost commission that kind of studied college costs to figure out what was wrong with them, and basically they came out with very few recommendations at that time, and anything that they did recommend really didn't change anything. So now they're kind of back at this point again, where they're looking at college costs and trying to become a little bit more involved than just studying the issue.
It would seem that after gas prices and health care costs, the number one kind of red flag spike is in this area of higher education. And even at the state level, many state governments have cut back on their support of state universities. Is that what's pushed state college tuitions up, Jeff?
Yes, it has. I mean, that's a big part of it. And also, a lot of publics are becoming more like privates. In other words, that they have to have a lot of the non-academic amenities that private colleges are known for. They have to have the best dorms, the best fitness centers, high-speed internet access. I mean, all that stuff, which parents and students often demand, is cost money. And so somebody has to pay for it. And at the end of the day, states are paying less and less of the bill at public colleges. And as a result, public college tuition is going up.
If you go to school at a country club, it's going to cost something like a country club. Jeff Salengo.
One of the things, though, to remember is that when people talk about college costs, you know, a lot of people think of what a private college education costs, you know, something around $20,000 a year in tuition and fees. But the average public four-year college still costs only around $5,000. So compared to a private college, it is much, much cheaper.
Yeah, but of course, we know what an awful lot of Americans make, and many at the lower end of the income spectrum not even going anymore. In some quarters, going in smaller portion than they did decades ago.
Very true. I mean, the cost of a college education obviously eats up a lot more of a lower-income student's budget than it does of a higher-income student's budget. For example, at a private college, those in the lowest quartile, the percentage of family income that it takes to pay tuition is about 64%. That compares to about 18% in the highest quartile.
And that's a real pinch, 64%.
Yeah, 64% is a real pinch. Now, it is interesting to note that has actually dropped since the late 80s. In the late 80s, it was actually 77%. And these figures I'm quoting come from the College Board, which studies these issues every year.
That's terrific. Jeff, thanks for opening the window on this for us.
No problem.
Jeff Salengo, senior editor at the Chronicle for Higher Education. Joining me now from Athens, Ohio, is Richard Vedder, professor of economics at Ohio University and author of Going Broke by Degree, Why College Costs So Much, published by the American Enterprise Institute. Richard Vedder, thanks for being with us.
Glad to be with you, Tom.
Also with us this hour from Hanover, New Hampshire, Jack Beatty, On Point News analyst. Jack, good to have you.
Good to be here, Tom.
Richard Vedder, you've been writing about this. Everybody has their own statistical take on it. Give us yours. What are the big numbers that explain what's going on?
Well, the rise in college tuition costs is not a new thing. In fact, there was a study done in the 1960s that argued that college tuition costs have risen more than inflation since 1905. So this has been going on for a century. It's getting to the point, though, where the rise in tuition costs is exceeding the growth in people's incomes, and that can't go on indefinitely. It simply cannot. It's a mathematical impossibility to go on indefinitely. So the pinch is growing, just as it was with health care 10, 15, 20 years ago, and people are starting to recognize that something has to be done. Why is it happening? I guess one could say colleges are raising their tuition levels because they can get away with it. And one important factor is that the demand for higher education is growing rapidly, in part fueled by all of these federal programs that were talked about earlier, the loan programs and so forth. Cost a lot of money to go to college? Well, I don't have the money, but I can borrow the money. So students and their parents are less sensitive to price than they would be if there were not third parties involved.
But you know, Richard Vedder, at the same time, there's a lot of blood, sweat, and tears going into writing out checks, not just loan tickets here, but checks that are going to these campuses.
Absolutely. And it is beginning to pinch in such a way that you do see What I am beginning to detect as a worrisome trend, namely that there are certain groups in society that are being shut out, even with all the discounting of tuition, student aid, and so forth that's going on. There are some groups that have, just simply not participating much in the college experiment experience, including, for example, I saw a statistic that suggests that a smaller proportion of Hispanic Americans today go to college, that is those between the ages of 18 and 24, mm-hmm. a smaller percentage go to college today than did in 1976.
That's a long time ago, and to have it go in that way, of course, there's been a lot of immigration since then. I suppose there's a bigger demographic picture here as well. Jack, we've got a break coming up, but I want to hear from you. This trend toward this huge range of tuitions going way up in the stratosphere, 42,500 plus a year at Columbia this academic year, one wonders about its impact on the kind of social and class structure of America.
Well, one way to look at it is this. About 2 million GIs got a four-year education under the GI Bill, slightly more than that.
After World War II.
After World War II. Before World War II, colleges were bastions of privilege. Fewer than 10% of Americans went. After World War II, and with the legislation of the 60s, it rose to nearly 30%. But 2 million, as it happens, 2 million is the figure of the amount of the number of low-income qualified students who will not go to college over the current decade if current trends continue. So imagine America without the 2 million GIs going through college under the GI Bill, and what we have today is something similar without these 2 million people who are being excluded from college today.
And when I grew up, those GI Bill graduates were everywhere. They were manning American society. Jack, Richard Vedder, please stand by. We've got to take a short break. We're talking about the cost of college over the moon and still rising. Are you feeling the sticker shock right now? Are you looking at $10,000, $20,000, $30,000, $40,000 a year and up for college? How are you doing it? We're at 1-800-423-8255. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We'll be right back. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour about the cost of college over the moon and still rising, and we're asking why and what might be done about it. You can join the conversation. What do you see driving the high cost of college? How could it be reined in? Are we turning these super expensive schools into country clubs? Have you seen the rock walls, the coffee bars, the giant hot tubs? And this, is high tuition itself becoming a kind of status symbol, a new way of dividing Americans? We're joined this hour from Athens, Ohio, by Richard Vedder. He teaches economics at Ohio University. He's an adjunct scholar at the American Enterprise Institute, author of Going Broke by Degree, Why College Costs Too Much. Jack Beatty is with us as well. Richard Vedder, you began to wade into why these costs are going up so high. You've broken them out in some detail. You've got six big factors, and I wish you'd take us through those briskly here so we can get a sense of the waterfront of what's driving this.
Okay. Well, I mentioned already the rising demand for higher education, which is partly fueled by the student aid programs, although partly by other things.
Yes.
There's also a lack of market discipline among universities.
Meaning?
Meaning universities are mostly nonprofit institutions. They have little incentive to cut costs, to try. The market isn't pushing them to make profits, which usually means keep your costs down, improve the quality of your product.
There's no bottom line there.
There's the no bottom line mm-hmm. factor. That's mm-hmm. right. We also have had some de-emphasis of undergraduate instruction, particularly at the larger research universities.
Why would that drive costs up or tuitions up?
Well, it means that money that the state governments, for example, are giving to state universities that normally would go to sort of help pay for the undergraduate instruction, some of that money is getting siphoned off for other things like research. Administrative bureaucracies are growing rapidly. Some of the country club-like factors that were mentioned earlier mm-hmm. is another factor. Another factor that has already been alluded to is what us economists call price discrimination, the fact that we charge different customers at different amounts. And we've become much colleges have become much more aggressive about this in recent years, and so they charge the more affluent customers who have no special qualities that the universities want. They charge them whatever the traffic, whatever the market will bear, and they become more aggressive about that.
Let me ask you about that one. That means when Columbia comes out with its new package here, 42,500 plus this year, you're saying that means that sort of good students, but not extraordinary students, but families with plenty of money are going to pay the full freight. Many others won't. So does that mean that these big numbers are kind of just scaring us without real impact, that it's only wealthy families that are actually paying them?
Although I agree mostly with what Jeff had said earlier, I think he tends to minimize the fact that, first of all, about a quarter of the people going to college are paying the full freight.
And a quarter of Americans aren't rich, that's for sure. Sure.
Yeah, no, that's right. And also, we are finding that student aid, which used to go mainly for low-income people, increasingly at American universities are going to buy good students or even, of course, good athletes, people with talents that the universities want because they help the universities go up in the rankings or whatever. And in doing that, we're making it harder for the middle and low-income students, who are not bad students necessarily, but to realize the dream. To get to the last two points,
yes,
because I know you want to get others involved in this conversation, productivity at universities has been relatively stagnant over the last two or three generations.
Productivity meaning in this case what?
The,
how do you measure?
The amount of work you get out of, say, a faculty member or a staff member. It actually takes more staff members to educate a given number of students than it did 30 years ago.
Does that mean they're doing less, or they're lollygagging, or is it good? Are they doing research that's important?
It could mean that, but a lot of it is, and I'm a member of this university community myself, a lot of it is we're just doing other things. We're not in classes many hours of the week. We are doing more research. We are doing more other things. But we haven't used technology and other things to raise productivity, which is the commonplace in the rest of the economy. The other thing, and this is certainly the most controversial thing I might say for some members in the university communities, is that universities in the last decade or two have become very generous, particularly at the upper levels of their staff, both on the faculty and the administration, of treating themselves pretty well. All this new money coming into universities from higher tuition and so forth, a lot of it gets siphoned off in higher salaries and benefits and so forth.
You cite a figure of for full-time professors, salaries up well over 50% in real terms since 1980. Certainly that's not the national trend among all Americans.
No, and it's not true among all faculty, by the way. In defense of faculty, for example, if you look at community college salaries over the last generation, they've been pretty flat. In fact, they've in some ways, they've certainly declined relative to other people in the American economy.
And we hear plenty about that, so maybe it's the superstar phenomenon here, a lot paid to the big names?
Yeah, it is, and of course we see this in other walks of American life too, not just higher education. But look at the university presidents today who are making $500,000, $750,000 a year, who used to make, in today's dollars, maybe $150,000 or $200,000 a year. Same with the superstar faculty. There are faculty people at top universities that are being paid $250,000, $300,000 salaries, teaching one course a term, maybe two courses a year. And when you have these kind of expenses, you know, you're talking about a financial problem.
Jack Beatty, there's a whole boardwalk of causes for why tuition, room, board, and all the rest are headed up. And we know there are loan programs out there, but still, for American families sitting down at the kitchen table, many, many of them, even relatively affluent ones, trying to swallow a nut this big, this is a big, talk about rock climbing, this is a big wall to climb.
It is. I mean, one study of 146 selective universities found that only 3% of their students came from the lowest income quartile, whereas 75% came from the highest. Now, that's not a recipe for a more egalitarian society. You know, it's strange. The university was one of the institutions that reproduced class differences up until the 1940s. Mm-hmm. And then for a long time, it mitigated them. It actually was an instrument of mobility for people who wouldn't be able to go there. Now it looks like we're returning to that earlier model because of these costs and because of the effect it has on people. You know, it's true, sticker shock, no one necessarily has to, or many don't pay the full freight, but many don't even know the name of opportunity. I read an interview recently with a Stanford graduate who got a from Los Angeles, who was offered a scholarship there, and he said when he got that scholarship offer, he said, Stanford, that's a city in Connecticut, isn't it?
It's just beyond reach, beyond imagining almost.
He didn't know the name of opportunity, and that is true all across America, and part of it is the very sticker shock and the effect it has on family.
There's a painting of stratification. Jack, Richard Vedder, please stand by. I want to welcome into our conversation from Murray, Kentucky, F. King Alexander. He is president of Murray State University in Kentucky. Testified before Congress a couple of years ago on the rising tuition pattern and the college cost crisis. Annual tuition at Murray State is $4,428, not including room and board, but not at the top of this pile, and we're very interested in his perspective. President Alexander, thanks for joining us.
Thank you for allowing me to join the conversation.
So what do you make? You've got a modestly priced, low-cost institution there, and yet you see this whole range of tuitions, room and board packages being charged across the country. Is it reasonable what Americans are being asked to pay for college education? Is it out of control? How do you see what's going on?
I think it's very difficult to generalize in a broad sense what is actually going on, because I think we need to differentiate where the bulk of the students are, quite honestly.
Yes.
Many of the lowest cost institutions, and Jeff pointed out that the average cost is about $5,000, it's $5,100 nationally for tuition and fees. Over 50% of the student population generally are in schools of the lowest cost or in these type of institutions paying $5,000 or less. We also at Murray State University have the autonomy to raise prices at will, quite honestly. Mm. But because of our mission, our specific mission, we remain about 25% below the national average. We serve one-third Pell Grant students, eligible students. We're not unusual. Many, what I would consider the majority of institutions, whether they're American Community College system institutions or the ASCU institutions, our regional public universities are maintaining and sticking to these mission-oriented pricing structures.
But I want to understand exactly what you're suggesting there, F. King Alexander. If you've got a national average there for $5,100 for a lot of students, of course, we know what per capita income is, just over $20,000, and household income, what is it? Is it $40,000 now median? So are you saying that at $5,100 a year, tuition, the cost of college for that large portion of American students is not an issue?
Oh, I know. I certainly think it's an issue, and it is a growing issue, and there are a lot of factors that are feeding into this. But first, let me differentiate between sectors. In the public sector, the number one issue, and this is one thing that Congress tried not to recognize, was the fact that why are tuitions going up in public sector institutions? Mm. Well, quite frankly, the number one issue, and it correlates and actually shows exactly the same case in the early 80s, early 90s, and in the last couple years, has been the decline of state appropriations. We've gone from basically 50% of all public university funding in 1981 to roughly 36.5% now.
Why would states not want to fund higher education? Isn't that the future of any state, of its economy?
Well, I think that's a very good question, and I think that's a good question for the federal government to look into, because states want, in fact, the irony of all this is states want universal access now. And in fact, the last argument that I've seen against universal access was in 1992, I think, in an editorial written by George Will about not everybody deserves to go to college.
Universal access, you mean they want every citizen of their state to be able, if they choose, to go to college?
For economic reasons, states all over the United States, and it's a nonpartisan issue, have made the determination that students, all students, need some form of post-secondary education.
So why cut the funding? Are they just leaning on the federal government, counting on it to step into the breach, or does it not?
Well, a little of both. I think that it is easier for states to remove themselves from their responsibilities because they can, and this goes back to Professor Vedder's point, they can, particularly with regard to loan availability, regard to Now, with the emergence of tax credits, which also feed into the system, and with the constant issue of grants, which are being debated, the increases seems to be every 3 or 4 years, state governments can move away from funding greater access to higher education. The other thing that states are doing is that they are insisting on greater productivity, and in fact, this is where I would perhaps argue with Professor Vetter's point on productivity.
Mm-hmm.
In some cases, among some of the elite public universities, that the stance that they're not as productive or not becoming more productive can be made, but most of higher education nationwide has seen a decline in per-student state appropriations just in the last 3 years from $6,800 to $5,700. So you could argue that we're more efficient than we've been in nearly two decades in terms of what we're spending on students and the state spending. The question is, how do we continually serve more students with less state money? Because that's what we're also being asked to do.
And the question at the kitchen table is, for how many years or decades can the cost of a college education rise so much more quickly than inflation, than family income? Do we reach a tipping point here at some point, F. King Alexander, where this begins to turn around? How far can this go?
Well, I would like to see it turn around. Certainly, this also gets into the dynamics of the federal discussion of using percentages to sanction institutions.
What do you mean by that?
When we talk about percentage increases in tuition, we need to be real careful, because most of the schools that have the highest percentage increases nationally are the schools that charge the least amount of money.
Like your own, Murray State.
Like our own institution, which may increase tuition 1 year by 16%, which might lead to a federal sanction, when we may have an institution down the street like Vanderbilt who increases at 4%. And the actual increase that Vanderbilt did from 1 year to another is more than what we charged the entire year.
So a 4% increase at Vanderbilt, fancy schmancy school, equals maybe an 80% increase at Murray State.
Precisely, and that's the danger of using percentages in this dialogue in this current environment. We know our students don't pay in percentages, they pay in dollars, and our families pay in dollars, and we need to focus a little more on dollars when we're talking about tuition, as well as when the federal government gets involved, they need to pay closer attention to those schools that have fought long and hard to keep costs low, so that they're not
penalized,
sanctioned at the when the smoke clears.
Right. Well, families and students certainly focused on dollars. I want to begin to bring our listeners into this conversation. Rita is calling from Durham, North Carolina. Hi, Rita. You're on the air.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call.
Yeah. What do you see?
Well, I have a couple of comments. First off, I'd like to hear some discussion. I should start by saying I'm a student at Duke Law.
All right.
And I completely agree about the astronomical costs. I'm here on a scholarship for which I feel extremely fortunate, and I was lucky enough to have the same provisions for my undergraduate and graduate work. I know I would not have been able to afford such a prestigious school otherwise.
May I ask you, Rita, may I just ask you if you got those lovely scholarships because of financial need or because you're so brilliant?
It was academically driven.
Oh, well, lucky you.
Thank you. But the point that I'd like to bring up is that while I've been searching for jobs and getting ready to leave law school, I found that the name of your school carries incredible weight in the job search community, at least for your first couple offers.
Mm-hmm.
And so the problem of these astronomical costs for students who aren't able to go to these name brand universities means not only are they locked out for their educational purposes, but they're also locked out in terms of their future advancement. Often your first job may be predicated a lot getting your foot in the door by that name.
Right, that status issue. Rita, our time is short before the break, but let us pick that up. Richard Vetter, I mean, that gets back to it here. F. King Alexander is educating students at under $4,500 a year, but there is this brand name dynamic that kicks in, and suddenly people feel like they have to have the Gucci brand on their university education.
Yes, that's right, and that's one reason why the Dukes of the world and the Harvards and Northwesterns and Stanfords can get away with charging $40,000.
But isn't it discriminatory in another sense? I mean, I know it always has been, but as Jack Beatty says, the country kind of tried to get out of that in the mid-20th century.
And Jack also said, and I quite agree with him, that we seem to be moving back to it. I understand that the median income of parents of Harvard undergraduate students today is well over $150,000 a year. We are largely the elite private schools are largely a enclave for the upper middle classes and upper classes, and we're perpetuating an intellectual aristocracy, may be the wrong word, that's the danger we're running into, and that's the problem. And King is right about this. I mean, King Alexander, I agree with King on most of two-thirds of what he says.
We'll come back and look at that. Noblesse oblige works out there a little bit. Harvard now says if your family makes under $40,000 a year, you can come for free. But you hear what the average income of that elite school is, and it's replicated around the country. Richard Vedder, F. King Alexander, Jack Beatty, please stand by. We're talking about the cost of college over the moon. You can join us. Are super high tuitions reflecting the country's wealth gap? Are they now reinforcing it? And are high college tuitions driving Americans apart by class? We're at 1-800-423-8255. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.
Support for On Point comes from the listeners of WBUR Boston. Bicon Dental Implants, offering short implants that can eliminate the need for bone grafting. Information is available at bicon.com, BICON.com. And Private Wealth Management at Babson Capital. For more than 60 years, helping clients build and preserve wealth through financial planning, investment management, and trust services. In Cambridge and on the web at BabsonCapital.com.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour about the cost of college over the moon and still rising. We're asking why and what to do about it. You can join the conversation at 1-800-423-8255. We've been joined in this hour from Murray, Kentucky, by F. King Alexander, president of Murray State University, where the tuition is still at $4,428. There's a target for you if you need it. But we see the bigger national picture, huge tuitions, huge packages all over the place, $40,000 plus. Richard Vedder joins us from Athens, Ohio, teaches economics at Ohio University, author of Going Broke by Degree, Why College Costs Too Much. Jack Beatty's with us as well. Flavio is joining us right now from Providence, Rhode Island. Hi, Flavio. You're on the air.
Hi. Thank you for taking my call.
Sure.
So I'm a medical student at Brown University. And I wanted to bring up the issue of the federal Perkins Loan Program, which is really the core of loans for students from working class backgrounds.
The Perkins Loan Program. Are you taking advantage of it, Flavio, in med school at Brown?
Actually, for the fourth year in a row now, in the appropriations process in the federal government, there has been no new capital contributions. And slowly this program is dissipating. And a big concern of mine is I believe that the federal government has a responsibility to make higher education more accessible. And slowly this program is eroding due to lack of investment from the part of the government.
Flavio, let me ask you, if I may, you're going to come out of Brown Medical School and presumably make a pretty good income. So maybe even without it, what, are we in the George Bush market-driven era? Maybe you don't really need it. Maybe take out the loans, pay it back when you're a well-paid doctor.
Well, here's the thing. I'm beginning my second year now, and I already have $105,000 in debt.
Ouch.
This is not including what I have from undergraduate. About $27,000 of this is from private banks, because the federal loans do not cover the full cost of education at Brown.
Yeah.
And pretty soon
you're under a big pile of debt. Flavio, I want to ask our guest to address that. F. King Alexander, Flavio says the federal support, the Perkins Loan Program in particular, is not coming through for him in the face of these big bills.
Well, I think it's important to also, you mentioned this Chavez-Regal effect that is termed the prestige impact, and the student from Duke University also discussed it. In New England, this certainly permeates the higher education market more so than it does the Midwest, the South, and the western part of the United States.
By that you mean people aiming for very expensive universities for the Chavez-Regal kind of brand, so it's Flavio's own fault to have chosen such a prestigious school?
No, I think it has a way of distorting the market. It distorts the market for the institutions. It distorts the market for parents because they're able. They are enabled by many of these programs in some ways to escalate some costs in some circumstances, particularly in for-profit higher education, as we've seen throughout the country, but also in northeastern institutions we're looking, at least charging a lot equates to having high quality. That's certainly not the case in states like Kentucky, North Carolina, California, Florida, and other states throughout the nation.
That's merciful.
Yes, certainly, and we're glad it's not the case.
Mm-hmm.
I think perhaps one way of helping Rhode Island or a Brown University in this circumstance is making sure that Brown is using their resources wisely. Their per-student expenditures have probably shot up considerably over the last 15 years, and while they're caught up in this spiral effect that's going on in New England.
Mm-hmm. So Brown, take a shot over the bow from the president of Murray State. Get your spending in order. But I wanted to just follow up on what Flavio said about the federal support. Are you saying it's not being crimped, or that it's there, and it's just that some schools are so expensive it's not sufficient?
I'm saying, in some cases, particularly in the higher charging institutions or the higher sticker priced institutions, that there's a debate going on right now. Should you expand the loan volume? Should you expand the loan debt considerably so that the loan caps make more funds available to students so that students can then actually utilize more funds for college at higher priced institutions?
Or does that just drive up those tuitions ultimately when the funds are available? Richard Vedder, this is kind of your hobby horse. You and other conservatives have said, let's cap off this federal money because it's feeding the upward spiral.
I think it is feeding the upward spiral. Now, I don't disagree with King Alexander, and the one point he's making that's very important is that there's enormous disparities in the United States, not only regionally, but between types of institutions and how they operate. The community colleges are altogether different than the Browns, the Dukes, the Harvards of the world. But the federal student loan programs put together collectively, and I'm not talking just about Perkins Loan, I'm talking about all of them, mm-hmm. and all the programs put together. Let's put all student aid programs of any kind together. For the last 11 years, the compounded annual increase in the amount of money spent has been about 11% a year, as I read the College Board data cited earlier.
Yep.
That's a huge increase. You drop money out of airplanes over students' houses, they're going to take the money and go, and the colleges are going to raise their tuitions, and they're going to engage in practices that add to costs, and we're enabling this process.
And yet, on the other side, but on the other side, families are looking at these bills coming down, and if they don't have help from somewhere, Jack Beatty, where are they supposed to turn? I mean, I understand the dynamic Richard Vedder is describing, but what are you going to do? Leave people hanging out there?
Yeah, that's a paradoxical situation, isn't it? I mean, you're sort of saying blaming the victim, that it's the student with his loan who's driving up the rates. Now, that may well be true in some perverse way, and that needs to be looked at. Mm. But, you know, people, you've asked Tom what to do about it.
Yes.
William Bowen at Princeton has done a study of 18 elite colleges, and he says what we need are, quote, we need a new thumb on the scale. Not just the racial thumb for affirmative action, but a class thumb. That if colleges gave all applicants from the poorest fourth of society the same edge as it gives relatives of alumni, this is in the most elite school, admissions would rise from about 32% to 47% of such students. That would cost about 12% increase in financial aid. He says the only way to crack this, what we seem to be having, these new barriers emerging, these new bastions of privilege, the only way to do it is to put a new thumb on the scale.
A thumb on the scale to keep in mind how colleges do shape the nation, the society we live in. Let's get a call. Jean is calling from Belmont, Massachusetts. Hi, Jean. You're on the air.
Hi. I'm calling because I do have a daughter who goes to a prestigious private college here in the Boston area.
How's it going? Is it breaking the bank, or is it all right?
It is breaking the bank. She's going to be a third year. Mm-hmm. The first 2 years, she got a modest grant from the school, and we were able to cough up the rest of it by taking out a loan ourselves. She was not she could only qualify for Stafford the first 2 years for something a total of $2,000 a year. Now, this year, our oldest daughter graduated from college.
That's a relief.
No, she's going to graduate school.
Oh, okay.
And
the party goes on.
Right. And now the college that my younger daughter goes to said, well, she's out of college. We are not giving you any money whatsoever. So we were left hanging. with a 41,000 plus tuition and room and board.
Gene, where does that land? Is it coming out of your retirement ultimately? Is it debt your daughter's going to carry forward?
She had to take out more or less, is the other point. She had to take out more loans, which is okay to a point, but because she works at the Board of Admissions, she tells people when they come to visit the school says that you will not graduate with more than $13,000 in loans.
Is that going to be her experience?
She's already at, she'll be at $13,000 next year.
And the clock is still, the counter is still ticking there. Gene, thanks for your call. Efkin Alexander, a couple things for you. I washed dishes through college and managed to make it through. Can students still work their way through college today? Is that a doable thing?
Well, they can. They certainly can. And I think the last statistics I've seen are about 75% are working their way through college, which raises some other questions. Certainly tuitions have made it difficult for them to finish without working. What generally happens in that case is students take less course, they reduce their course load, and they take a longer time to finish, which is counter to what many state legislatures want them to do. They want them to finish faster.
Right. Mm-hmm.
They want them to find their majors at orientation and get them in and out as quickly as possible so they can put more people in the mm-hmm. system.
And finally, if I may ask you, President Alexander, for everyone listening here, what do you have to say about quality and cost? Are Americans too hung up on fancy brand name institutions? Can they get the quality at lower cost and maybe not drive the spiral?
I think there's perhaps a more important question in the policy arena.
Mm-hmm.
In the 60s, when we had developed a federal system that encouraged, was supposed to encourage both access and choice, we're getting in a dangerous circumstance where things have a dangerous situation where choice is superseding access. And the federal government, I think it's time for a new federal debate about how they're going to finance higher education if they want universal access and they want low-cost institutions to provide the bulk of that lower income access.
You're saying they're paying too much out of federal coffers for fancy universities?
Well, the question, quite frankly, should you expand those loans, subsidized loans and grants and tax credits, so one student can choose to go to Brown, for instance, or do you provide those resources for two or three to go to Chapel Hill?
That, Richard Vedder, that gets right to the class issue.
It certainly does, and I think King Alexander is raising a point. One reason why the problem that King earlier raised is that state appropriations are falling is that they're getting squeezed. If you were a state legislator and you're facing Medicaid bills going mm-hmm. up 15-20% a year, what do you have to do? We have to provide K-12 education. We have to provide for health care for the elderly. These are absolute musts. Higher education is not an optional thing, but it's something that can be funded in other ways. It can be funded by the parents. It can be funded through loans. And so that's the kind of debate we're getting into. How do we allocate our dollars? And I think President Alexander is raising a valid point. Maybe we shouldn't be funding Cadillac educations for everyone in allocating the money in a different fashion.
Well, a national issue, an issue at many family kitchen tables. We're grateful to all of you for helping us sort through it in this hour. Richard Vedder at Ohio University, author of Going Broke by Degree, thank you very much for being with us.
Thank you.
And in Murray, Kentucky, F. King Alexander, president of Murray State University. President Alexander, thanks so much for being on.
Thank you for having me.
Jack, thanks for joining us this hour.
Thank you.
Listeners, to continue this conversation online, go to onpointradio.org and click on forums. In a moment, a call for universities to be a greater part of America's national conversation. This is On Point. Over the last couple of years, Tricia Rose has been a not infrequent guest on this show. She's professor of American Studies at the University of California at Santa Cruz and a specialist on 20th century American and African American culture and politics. Soon she'll be making her way back to campus for the fall semester. With the nation at war in Iraq, events unfolding in Gaza, and the upcoming battle over John Roberts' nomination in the Supreme Court, she finds herself wondering why academics haven't been a greater part of the national conversation. Tricia Rose brings us perspective we always value. We thought we'd hear it. She joins me now from Santa Cruz, California. Professor Rose, thanks for being with us.
Oh, it's my pleasure. How are you?
We're great, and we understand you're looking out across the country, maybe thinking back toward a time when campuses were hotbeds of political and intellectual ferment that ran into the political, and what, not seeing enough? Are you saying that these country clubs are falling asleep?
Well, you know, first, you know, let me say that there are definitely individuals who have had a tremendous impact, and individual scholars and intellectuals are trying to be in public conversation.
Mm-hmm.
Cornel West, Noam Chomsky, Martha Nussbaum, you know, Robert Lykoff. There are a number of people. But I am concerned that scholars seem to have moved away from a long tradition of public intellectual, not so much activism, but simply conversation. And to be part of that public dialogue is crucial. It's more important now than ever.
What are people, what are professors doing instead if they're not part of the public conversation?
Well, I mean, as in many other professions, they are working more than they had in the past for lots of reasons. But it's not that they're so much doing other things that they weren't doing before. It's that I think the conversation on these public issues is harder. It's harder to include academic and scholarly voices in these conversations because of the way we're having public conversation.
Because, you know? Why is it? Because the media whirlwind sort of pulls it away from a more deliberate campus-based dialogue?
Yeah, definitely it moves it away from a more deliberate conversation. I mean, I think we need more public, serious debates with long conversations. You know, when
mm-hmm.
you're dealing with issues like the Gaza Strip pullout, as you pointed
mm-hmm.
out, or the war in Iraq and the complexity of these types of international issues, you have to have time to unpack what's going on. And we live in an era in which very short, quick hits and sound bites and emotionally driven, easy oppositions, good, evil,
mm-hmm.
you know, right, wrong, drive mass commercial media in every arena, not just the news.
This
makes it much harder for a serious, mm-hmm. sustained conversation. We need much more lengthy news outlets for this type of conversational
mm-hmm.
space.
Mm-hmm. We try and give that kind of time right here, but I understand
absolutely.
In many venues it's not there. But let me ask you, you mentioned names like Cornel West and Noam Chomsky involved as public intellectuals, which makes me wonder, are you not hearing as much because it's shifting more to the right? These are very liberal voices. Maybe, Tricia Rose, you just don't recognize more conservative campus voices as the kind of intellectual voice you want to hear. Or am I being too cheeky there?
Well, a little cheeky, but I think I've certainly listened to conservative voices. But even those voices are locked in the kind of media soundbite, not counting On Point, of course. I'm talking about, you know, a much more mainstream,
mm-hmm.
Commercial-driven news television media, which is a different venue primarily. I think public debates with left and right critics would be terrific, right? Long debates, not shouting matches, not personal attacks, but serious, critical conversation so that most people can be educated. I mean, we have thousands and thousands of scholars who know so much, not simply for the point of taking a political position for and against the war, per se, but really giving the kind of historical background that we need. And there are some groups. There's been a group called Historians Against the War who happen to be against the war. They're not so much against Republicans. They feel that this war, based on historical precedent, is problematic. You know, what do historians think? What, given if people who spend their entire lives studying in great detail, you know, what are they thinking, really? Not, again, highly paid soundbite in people for a particular political position.
Mm.
So it's not just about being a left issue, although I count myself among the left, but it's not just the issue.
We've got it. Tricia Rose says, academics, grab the microphone. Professor Rose, thanks for being with us.
My pleasure.
Tricia Rose is professor of American Studies at the University of California at Santa Cruz. She's author of Black Noise, Rap Music, and Black Culture in Contemporary America. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.
On Point is a production of WBUR Boston and NPR, National Public Radio.